The Revenue Committee to order today. It's January 20th. It's 1:30. Actually, it's 1:32. And so we can get started. And so glad I was concerned about Representative Olson after session. I'm glad he's here, and he was a strong representative for all of us, and appreciate your good human nature. And if you missed the session, it was memorable, but we won't get into it here. With that, we're going to get started, and we're going to have Steve Meyer give us the overview about school finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. I am the economist that didn't make it to the lineup last Thursday, so if I looked unfamiliar, that's why. And today we want to deal with school finance. The general theme is sharing state and local resources. There are several topics that we want to cover, but primarily it will be the school equalization formula, how it operates, where the money comes from, where it goes, how it's divided up. And then if there's time after that, I'd like to touch on just the school use of the local option, maybe touch on the school stability fund, and then look at the numbers for the 05-07 biennium, given the governor's recommended state school fund appropriation level. So those are the general topics, but most of it will be on the school equalization formula. And I hope the word formula doesn't put you off or bring back any bad memories from school. We'll try to not challenge your math ability this morning and keep it simple. So with that in mind, if it does seem too complicated, tell me to slow down or back up, or we can talk more after the meeting, or whatever it takes to get you up to speed. I'm not going to talk too much this afternoon about numbers. I want to deal more with the process and with the concepts, but there will be numbers involved.
Before we get started, Mr. Meyer, I'd like to interrupt for just a moment. And once Paul gets back up here, I think he's going to tell me I forgot to welcome our guest today.
You're actually Representative Olson's constituents.
Well, right. Representative Olson, would you like to introduce our guests today and welcome them?
Madam Chair, thank you. Anyways, I have friends and constituents down there out of Albany with Albany leadership that are visiting today. And this is but a small section of them, because the rest of them are scared and are outside. So,
thanks. Welcome, and thanks for coming. Yeah.
And I hope you learn as much as we do.
I hope they learn more.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, Representative Olson, we will not address the question, okay?
Thank you.
Inside jokes, folks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank all the other people in the audience today for attending and doing your best to understand the tough choices and difficulties that we're going to be facing in education with this budget this year. Mr. Meyer.
Just want to put a brief plug in for a computer printout that I do on the school formula that shows the distribution of dollars by school district. So if there's some policy change, I'll try to put that through the formula and have a printout for that. So if you see one of those and have questions about it, stop by or give me a call. Okay, just in the way of overview to get some idea of the magnitude of the school finance funding in terms of what it pays for, we've got about 550,000 students in the public school system. That doesn't include those that are in the private schools or homeschooled. There's about 35,000 teachers and aides employed in that process, with 19,000 support staff at 1,200 school sites. And that then is administered in 198 school districts. So the support staff is basically everybody that isn't in the classroom, whether it's the school bus driver, the janitor, the cafeteria staff, or whomever. This, again, is a big picture slide to give you an idea of the school resources. This is audited data after the school year is over, so that you only see data up to 02-03. You can see the pattern in the local revenue at the bottom again with the decline from Measure 5, an increase in 96-97 before Measure 50, and then the effect of Measure 50 after that, lowering the property taxes and then growth subsequent to that as assessed value grew. And then the amount of the state dollars growing over that time period, the federal have stayed fairly constant, as well as the intermediate. The beginning balance, you can see starting to decline in 02-03, which would have been at the beginning of that year. Once we have 03-04 data, we'll be able to see how much that probably goes down again. Then the big difference is the bond amount, and that's not from a big boom in school construction. That's primarily from funding PERS costs and making the school district selling bonds, making the payments to be actuarially up to date for their PERS expenses. Okay, what we want to do now then is jump right into the funding sources for the school equalization formula, and we'll just be talking about a part of that screen that you just saw. The state school fund is the big state source for school formula. Well, all of it comes through the state school fund. What isn't perhaps widely understood is that all of it doesn't come from the general fund. You have 91% in the 03-05 biennium coming from from the general fund, 7% lottery and 2% other. The other 2% is primarily the education stability fund dollars that were used to help balance things in the 03-05 biennium. And that's out of a total of $4.9 billion for that 03-05 biennium. The state school fund isn't all used for schools. It's for education, but it doesn't all go to the school districts as we sometimes assume. Some of it comes off the top, a small amount, at least in 03-05 for small high schools. That was for one biennium and will not be continued unless you pass legislation to do that. Another amount, small amount, $16.5 million, was for special education for state programs. That goes to help fund the education for students that are have extended stays in hospitals or are in long-term care or in the deaf and blind school. So that's off of the top. Then the rest of the state school fund goes either to school districts or education service districts. And within the school districts, it includes youth corrections and detention program students. So again, some of that money is going to those state programs rather than to local districts.
Madam?
Representative Berger.
Sorry, excuse me. Explain, Steve, when you say that it goes to the youth correction, in other words, it goes to the district and they transfer, if they have a student, does it go with the student? How does it go there?
No, it goes to the state program.
Okay, it goes directly from us to the program. Okay, thank you.
Those two programs are treated as though they are school districts.
I got it.
Okay. Representative Felizio.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A big picture question before we get more into detail. Are there any other states, and if so, which ones, and that have such dependence on, you know, state financing for school? I mean, how does Oregon compare?
Well, we're not number one. Hawaii is number one. They have a state system. I haven't looked at that data lately. I can't tell you offhand where we would be on just state dollars. But fairly high on the scale. Okay, next, local formula revenue. We have these sources, and only these sources that are included in the formula. Operating property taxes, so it excludes any bond property taxes. And it's taxes collected, not taxes billed to the taxpayer. So that the collected taxes would be taxes paid for the current year as well as any taxes due for past years that were paid in the current year. So it's strictly a collected amount. Some from the Common School Fund, that can vary depending upon the earnings of the fund. County School Fund is a relatively small amount. The federal forest revenue used to depend upon the amount of trees cut in the federal forest and the price of the timber. Right now they're making almost a fixed payment per year. It increases a little bit, and that will continue, I think, until 2006 under current law. And then we're not sure what will happen. The State Managed County Trust Force is your Clatsop and Tillamook State Force money that is shared with the local taxing districts, including school districts, and then some of it also goes into the county school funds for the school districts to benefit that way. The ESD excess local revenue is, in the past there has been some ESD revenue paid to school districts that would be included, but this is local revenue that ESD has to share with their local school districts, and we'll touch on that more when we talk about the ESD revenue distribution process. And then there's some very minor revenue in lieu of property taxes. But this is all local revenue. Perhaps the local portion or title is not too appropriate, but in 1991, when the formula was put together, these were all sources for the local school districts, and so they kind of all got lumped under this title and generally are related in one way or another to land, or were in the past, and so it's still referred to as local. What perhaps is just as significant is what isn't included in this list. Okay? So anything that's a gift, a donation, a transfer, interest earnings, fees, charges, any other kind of revenue that the school district might have is not included. And that was a small amount in 91. It wasn't all that important, but it's becoming more important with recent actions that you're aware of in terms of local government sharing revenue with the school districts. But the difference is, going back to why some of those sources aren't included, if they're voluntary, like a contribution of a foundation, the foundation probably wouldn't make that contribution if they knew that revenue would help the district from the contribution, but if it hurt the district in terms of what they would be available for in state dollars from the formula. Local revenue, out of $2.3 billion in 2003-05, most of it is from property taxes. The federal component is about 3%, common school fund 2%, and the other 2%. If we put now the state dollars and the local dollars together, right, the picture changes a little bit. The state school fund share is about 68%, property taxes 30%, and other 2% out of the $7.2 billion in formula revenue in the 2003-05 biennium. That 2 years ago, that split was a little bit different. The state school fund was about 70% for several years, and local 30%. But with the slowing of the growth in the state school fund, that's becoming a slightly smaller percent of that total, and could become even smaller this next biennium. The first split that we want to make is between schools and ESDs. Okay? We have one big pot of, well, we're going to define a big pot of money, but eventually we'll get to that split in the next slide. If we start with the state school fund and then take off the top the dollars that go to the state programs and any other uses that you approve, like the small high schools in this biennium, take that out. Then we have the state school fund dollars that are left, and if we combine both school and ESD local dollars with those available state school fund dollars, we get the total amount available for allocation to both school districts and ESD. So that's the big pot that we start with. Then, using that, we split it into two different amounts, 95% for school districts, 5% for ESDs, and that starts in this 05-06 fiscal year. Before that, ESDs were in the process of going through their equalization phase-in, and they started out at less than 5%, and over that time period phased up to their 5% share. school district started out at a little bit more than 95% and phased down to 95%. So there's been a bit of a shift in that process so that ESDs would have a few more dollars to help in that equalization process. Then once you have those splits, if you subtract the local revenue of schools and ESDs, you can find their state school fund shares. Although that's not all that important to know that. What's more important is the total amount after taking the 95 and 5% split. Okay, now we have the dollar amount then for school districts. Let's talk more directly about the formula and the state school fund. I wanted, I guess, to clarify maybe up front what the formula is not about. I debated whether to do this before talking about the formula more or after, and I decided to do it up front so that your expectations weren't raised too high in terms of what the formula could accomplish. It's not about a general cost reimbursement. There's cost reimbursement elements to it, but it's not a general cost reimbursement. It's not an entitlement formula that would be driven on a per student entitlement dollar amount. It's got nothing to do with adequacy or stability. There's nothing in it about student outcomes or achievement levels. And there's really nothing in it about either at the district level or the school level on the quantity of the inputs, the kind of program it is, or anything about accountability. All of these concepts are pretty much have come to the forefront in the school finance discussion after 1991, after the formula was established, and hasn't really been modified any or changed to try to address some of these concerns or ideas that have risen to the forefront since then. What it is about is defining school district equity. When I'm asked, do we have an equitable system here in Oregon? All I can say is, well, yes, we do, because it's what the legislature says is equity. The formula basically, in my mind, defines what equity is in this state for schools, for school funding from the state school fund and the local revenue that's been identified. And it measures equity then by coming up with a relative need. Given the money available, right, it doesn't set the money available, but given a pot of money available, what's the relative need of each school district in the state? What should their share of that total pot be? Given the kinds of students that's in that school district and perhaps some other district characteristics, right, those that are taken into account in the formula. Again, going back to it's being set up primarily in 1991, it reflects the finance issues and the court decisions from the 80s. The concern then was equalizing property wealth per student among school districts. So that's why you can see taking into account that local revenue and having an overall formula that takes into account both of those based upon primarily the court decisions in the mid-80s. And then refining equity by legislatively adopted policy choices over time. So it's available for modification and has been since 1991. When the working group was putting together the formula in 1991, they came up with four distribution principles to help guide how they would develop the formula. They decided that the formula should share state school funding sources statewide. And the method to implement that was to allocate all state and local operating revenue. That's what you saw on the list. Secondly, to let each district decide how to spend its allocation. And the method then basically is to assign a lump sum amount from the formula and not worry about categorical grants that the district has to meet to get funding. Third, to adjust funding only for uncontrollable cost differences or the most important cost differences among districts. And the method to do that then was to try to justify revenue differences in an irrational manner, and that gets into the weighting methodology that's used. And lastly, then, to avoid incentives to increase the district's allocation. To do that, there wasn't very many classifications of students in the weights in the weighting process, and there are some limits set in the formula. I think as we go through that, you'll see where these principles then come forward in the decisions and how the formula works. The cost factors that are in the formula are the student weights, as mentioned. There's one in there for teacher experience and an adjustment, so that if the teacher experience in the district is above or below the state average, that is taken into account in the dollars. One for transportation costs, one for high-cost disability students that was adopted last session, and sunsets again unless it's renewed or changed in some way to continue it. And then there's a cost facility factor that was adopted in 1999-2000, or started in 1999-2000. So given that, we start with an equalization formula in this format. It's state revenue plus local revenue using principle one equals the sum of four grants: the general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disability, and facility grant. So we'll get into more detail on each of those four, but you have the first two cost factors taken into account in the general purpose grant, and then the other three in the other grants. And you can match those up pretty clear. We're going to go in reverse order from left to right in the way they were listed in the prior slide. One, I think, because of trying to start with a fairly simple, straightforward one and work to the more complex. The other is that this one involves the fewest dollars and will work to the grants that involve more dollars. The facility grant equals up to 8% of construction costs, even though in the statutes you'll see 8% and not up to in that language. But there's a cap of $17.5 million per biennium for the facility grant. So if the eligible costs, 8% of the eligible costs exceed that $17.5 million over the biennium, then it gets prorated. And a district will get maybe 75% of their 8%.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair?
Representative Riley?
I have one question about that facility grant. Is that always the lesser of 8% or $17.5 million, or is it sometimes less than that?
Representative Riley, it has never been less than $17.5 million for the biennium.
Okay.
That limit has always been reached and exceeded. And that will become clear in a later slide. But the money cannot be used for construction. It's just the construction cost is the method to get to that amount, and it's paid in the school year the facility is first opened. This grant came about after Measure 50. And in Measure 50, there were some conditions on what could be bonded and what couldn't be bonded. The equipment in the classroom wasn't eligible for bonding any longer. So the legislature passed this to help growth districts that were adding new classrooms, going through a construction process to help furnish those classrooms. The cost can be either for new construction, additions, or portables, and it can include land costs in that process. Here's what the grants have been in the last two biennia. It only applies to roughly 40 districts a year, so it's fairly narrowly focused in terms of the districts that are developing new classroom space. You can see that the grants may be fairly equal each year, as in 99-01, or they may be very different, as in 0103, being very small in the first year and most of the construction being in the second year. One of the drawbacks is having it over the biennium is that in the first year of the biennium, you never know what the final facility grant is going to be. And you do some estimates, but you don't really know until you have the construction cost data for the second year in the biennium to finalize the first year. Okay. And then the percent, it's 5.6% for 99-01. It's dropped down to 3% in 01-03. So the 3% tells you some idea of, well, how much would it take to get up to 8%? Okay. So the costs have been, eligible costs have been much higher than what the funding is to achieve the 8% goal. The next grant is the high-cost disability grant. That's the new one. We don't really have much information on this grant yet. It's what's eligible are the costs for each high-cost disability student that exceeds $25,000. And once the school district spends $25,000 on that disability student, everything above that then becomes eligible. And those costs then are summed up by district for all the students in a district. And then they get that money as a reimbursement if there's enough money to do that. Right? Again, there's a limit or a cap of $12 million per year for that grant. The preliminary data indicates that they'll probably get maybe 75% of their dollars in that grant for that $12 million. But it's the numbers aren't real solid yet, even for 03-04. We probably won't have good numbers until late March, maybe April. So as the discussion of continuing that grant comes forward, it will probably be later in the year before we have good data to base that discussion on.
Madam Chair, question for this?
Yes. Representative Oakes.
Does the $25,000 include, for example, federal matching dollars, so on and so forth like that, or is that $25,000 limited to pure state-related or property tax-related dollars?
Representative Oakes, it is only state and local dollars. No federal dollars are to be included in that. And it does include any ESD dollars that are spent on that student.
I need I need clarification, Steve. So, we have monies that support special education students that come from the federal government. And so, once a district has expended those federal dollars, and we spent now $25,000 on a student, so then a district would be eligible to request additional funds out of the general fund for this, or is it a combination of a bunch of stuff here and I just messed you all up?
If the district is spending more than $25,000
right.
in state dollars and local dollars
okay.
on a student.
So we're not talking about the federal dollars.
We are not.
Okay.
We are not.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Haas.
Thank you. Steve, are the grant applications coming from any one region of the state, or is it just all over the map?
I don't know yet for sure, but it will be concentrated in the urban areas where the high-cost students tend to be because of the services, the medical and other services available in those areas. Okay, moving on then to the transportation grant. It again was another one of those that was changed in the last session. It used to be 70% of approved transportation costs for all districts. Last session, the change was to calculate a per student cost for all of the districts and then rank the districts from the high cost transportation cost per student to the low and give the top 10% of the districts a 90% inclusion of costs in the formula, the next 10%, 80%, and keep the bottom 80% of the districts at the 70%. The approved costs are for transporting the student between home and school. Can include transportation between school sites if the student has a class or one or more classes at another school site that they transfer between during the day. for handicapped students, for field trips, and then also for room and board in lieu of transportation, which applies to one school district in Eastern Oregon. Here you can see the dollars. These costs have increased over time, and what the 30% formula, non-formula amount is, and what the 70% formula amount cost is included. If the formula is funding the 70%, where does the other 30% come from? Where the 70% is coming from the transportation grant. The other 30% has to come in from other dollars, whether they are other state and local dollars in one of the other grants or from non-formula dollars. But just this amount is included in the formula. And I can't say for sure, but I assume that it was set at 70% to have some incentive for the districts to encourage efficiencies in transportation. Whether that's enough or not, I don't know. It's argued sometimes that it isn't enough.
Madam Chair, question?
Yes, Representative Paul, please.
Steve, could you go back to transfer? Could you highlight, I see that between, basically between 0, 0 and 3, those two biennames are kind of flat, and there's a big jump. I'm just wondering, is that reflective of the transportation or the fuel costs, or is there something not entering into fuel costs? Because as we know, across the economy, fuel costs have skyrocketed, and our local school district transportation costs have skyrocketed, but I don't really see it in that bar graph.
I'm not sure. 02-03, again, was a year when state funding decreased. I don't know if they were able to wring out some dollars out of the transportation costs by not buying new buses or something to keep that fairly level for 2 years. And then, and when funding went up in 03-04, were they making up for some of that? And again, those last 2 years are estimates to begin with, so that may have some effect. But I've talked to the Department of Transportation about that, and we haven't sorted through it yet as to what might be causing that and whether the estimates will change enough to make it look like, well, it has it stayed flat or is it starting to grow again with increases in transportation costs for fuel and wages primarily.
And if I could respond a little bit, Representative Boquist, but we did in our school district, we used to be very generous with, picking up students that were closer, and then as the funds got more tight and we had to do other cuts, then we really had to stick to the policy for the distance, and so that we weren't incurring more cost. In Woodburn, we've had several major intersections that were not safe for students, and so we chose to bus them through those intersections versus have the elementary children walk. And so then you have to make those tough decisions sometimes. But, yes, that's what happened.
Following comment, Madam Chair, if you indulge me. If I'm correct, I mean, Steve or Paul can answer this thing too, is that we're paying a formula-based on the biennium kind of forward, so we're really making an estimate. We paid X amount of dollars based on what we thought. It's not necessarily what we'd say truly a reimbursement cost is. It's a reimbursement because we're paying as we go along, correct?
Correct.
And so therefore, if the fuel, in the case of the Woodburn School District where they're very efficient, maybe one of my district was not so efficient, there may be quite a gap between what the formula allocated for this biennium and what reality is. Is that not correct?
Yes. The initial distributions are made on estimates that the school districts supply to the department. And if actuals vary substantially from whatever those estimates were, then yes, that is either made up or reduced in the final periods for that school year.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Moving on to the last grant, the general purpose grant. This may not be very meaningful when it says equal weighted students times $4,500 adjusted by teacher experience and balance of available funds. What's that all about? It's shorthand for trying to get an idea across, and we'll expand upon that, and hopefully by the end you'll understand what that's trying to tell you. But again, it's simple to keep the math simple, too. We have to build up a little bit in terms of calculating weighted students. And start out with the concept of, well, what are different ways of measuring students? For getting the number of students that are in the formula. The starting point is average daily membership, or ADM. And you'll hear ADM around the building or some of these abbreviations, so you really need to have an idea of what they mean. ADMR is just simply ADM of kindergarten at a half a weight. When you hear ADM around the building, people are probably talking about ADMR. At least I am. We just don't include the R on it. ADMW is simply ADMR adjusted for student cost weights, and we'll list each of those weights. And then there's the extended ADMW, or ADMW extended, which is the higher of the current or the prior year ADMW. Right, so this basically helps school districts that are losing students. If they're losing students in the current year, they can use the higher rated student count from last year to determine the number of weighted students to use in this year's formula calculation. The reasoning is that, well, there's a lot of fixed costs. If they're losing a few students, those fixed costs don't necessarily decrease right away. They have at least 1 year to make those adjustments for the reduced number of students. Average is over the school year. There's other measures. There's an enrollment number that may be used in some calculations. Other states use ADA, average daily attendance, so that you're not counting students that don't show up for the days that they don't show up, skip classes or what have you. They're still members of that school district, and they would still be counted in ADM. It's only the dropouts that are not counted in that average daily membership. Once they've, missed school for 10 consecutive days or whatever the test is for determining whether the student is a dropout or not. Starting with this set of weights, there's two sets. These are related to students, and students that are either in special education or considered at risk. The first one are the special education students that have individual education programs, written programs to follow for what kind of help they will get. They're labeled IEP students for individual education. They have an extra weight of 1 or a total weight of 2. And so each of those students count as 2 students in the formula. Students in poverty get counted an extra 1/4 for a total of 1 1/4. English language learners, ELLs, is a fairly new terminology. If you've been around here long enough, you might call them bilingual students or English as a second language students. So trying to keep up date with the terminology, but you won't see English language learner in all of the slides. You'll still see the old terminology in places. They have a weight of 1.5, and then there's special categories, private parenting, weight of 2, and those in neglected and delinquent or in foster homes having a weight of 1 1/4. The other distinction we want to make here is that some of these weights are identified with individual students, IEP students. The school district knows who they are and reports that number. Students in poverty, the school district does not report that number. It comes from census data, right? Estimates of students who are members of families that are considered to be below the poverty level. Since it's census data, you only have it every 10 years, it's adjusted between those 10 years based upon the change and the students in that district. So as the number of students grows, that poverty count increases during that 10-year period between censuses. The neglected and delinquent number comes from human services, so it's not identified with students. This gives you an idea of the relative magnitude of students in each of those categories. Poverty is the highest count, which initially surprised me a little bit that would be the case. Special education, about 70,000. English as a second language, or ELL, is about 50,000. And then small numbers for the other two categories. If you convert those weights to dollars and assume that the typical general purpose grant is $5,000 for a one-weighted student or regular student, right, then you can associate dollar amounts for the students in each of those other categories. So special education, each of those students then would generate about $10,000 of formula revenue, and so on. The other category of weights relates to grades or kinds of schools, kindergarten being the grade weight at 1/2. We still have a few elementary school districts and a Union High school district, with the elementary at 0.9 and the Union High at 1.2, using the assumption that it costs more in high school than grade school for those students. And if you combine the elementary districts in that Union High district with those high school students as though they were a unified district, the combination of the 0.9 and the 1.2 will give you a one weight. Okay. It's just a matter of weighting based upon number of grades. So that doesn't add or subtract. It just says between those elementary districts and that Union High district, here's how we want to split it up. Then there's the what's called the small school correction factor, dealing with the remote small elementary schools and the small high schools. The high schools used to have to be remote too, but that has been dropped. It was phased out so that the small high school no longer has to be remote. Elementary schools have to be at least 5 miles, if I remember that correctly, from another elementary school to qualify. If they are 10 miles, I believe it is, I hope that's right, they are totally remote. If they're between those two distances, they're partially remote.
Mm-hmm. Yes, me too.
Representative Berger.
Okay. As if I'm not remote enough, I want to go back to something that you said just before you got into remote.
Okay.
I know that 0.9 and 0.120 doesn't equal 1.
No, it's not.
There's few things that I'm pretty sure of in this world, and that's one of them. So would you, if the elementary district has a Union High School that is connected with it, the students in it are weighted 1, is that what you're saying? But if they are separate, then they're not?
They are separate.
Okay.
Okay. Let's assume that the elementary school has 8 grades and the high school has 4 grades.
Mm-hmm.
If you weight the 0.9 or 8/12, okay, and you take the 1.2 and weight it for the 4/12, you come up with 1.
Not having your training or ability, Steve, I am willing to be persuaded, but I'm sorry, I'm not yet. I'm not going to waste this. We're getting down to a pretty, but we'll discuss it later, and maybe I'll understand.
Yeah, I tried to pass over that.
I noticed that, but I just did the math, and I'm sorry. There's okay. Thank you.
That was my chair.
Okay.
I'm not there. I'm not tracking this.
Okay.
If we get into legislation that deals with this, I'll work through it with you.
Could you use building blocks? The visual?
I hope I don't have to. Okay. I'm not going to spend time on the qualification for small high school. I do want to say that the added weight depends upon the number of students in the high school. Right? If you have, say, 180 students in the high school, and you go up vertically from that count, The extra weights that are added because of that size is the vertical distance in the upper portion, or the shaded part of the graph. Right, so you may add 70 weights, or as though you had 70 extra students to that 180. That would be then the total because of the size of the high school. Elementary qualifications, skip over that. The elementary graph is very similar, only the scale is different. The schools are smaller. And it's based upon about 28 students per grade as a minimum amount. Yep, I see here is 12 miles from the nearest elementary school to be fully remote. I must do that. Okay, the student counts. After going through all the weighting process and calculating the ADMW extended, you can see over time what has happened to the growth in these counts. ADM grows more slowly than ADMW for two reasons over this time period. One is just because of the weights. The number of students in poverty, the number of students in special education programs is growing much faster than the overall student population. The second reason is that the definition has changed over that time period to bring in the students in the youth corrections, youth detention. And then there's been a bit of a change in the calculation for the small schools over this time period, so that has contributed to the growth in the weighted count being somewhat faster. And if you, in 04-05, ADMW extended is about 25% higher than ADM. To give you some idea of the scale.
Can I interject something here?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to use an example, and I will use my home district again. Woodburn has approximately 4,000 and some odd students, say 4,100. With our adjusted weight, which is 25% of that, we get paid for over 6,000 students. Does that help a little bit? Because we have the poverty and the second language learner and the special ed student. So instead of just getting paid $5,000 for 4,000 students, we get paid $5,000 for 6,000 students.
Yeah, okay. That helps quite a bit. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, teacher experience adjustment. Basically, this adjustment is helps districts that have more experienced teachers. If your average number of years of teacher experience is above the state average, let's say it's 1 year above the state average, that means an extra $25 per weighted student in the formula. But on the flip side, if your average is below the state average, it means $25 less per weighted student. So it's a way of giving a little bit more money to the districts that have the more experienced, presumably higher cost teachers than those that have the lesser experience that are further down on the scale. $25 hasn't changed since 1991. And initially, what I could find from doing a little bit of research on this is that it was about the amount of the cost to the district to move up the teacher for 1 year of additional experience. Right? It doesn't match that now, but that's where it started out. Okay, so overall, statewide, it's shifting money, but it isn't adding any or subtracting any. It just redirects it to the districts that have the more experienced teachers. Okay, now we're ready to put a little bit of math to that general statement in terms of what the general purpose grant is. The $4,500 is just an arbitrary number that was used in 1991 as a target. The funding level at that time was less than $4,500 per weighted student. So they said, well, let's put something in the formula as a goal to work toward. We're past it now, okay? But it's still there in the statute. The teacher experience adjustment, again, that's the $25 per year difference. in your average teacher experience to increase or decrease that $4,500 target. That's then multiplied by your extended weighted student count, and then times this mysterious balance ratio. Okay. What that does, what you have are the state dollars and local dollars in total have to equal the sum of these four grants. Okay. We know what the dollar amount is for the transportation grant. We know what it is for the facility because it's capped in effect. High cost disability, capped. The sum of those three grants then plus this general purpose grant has to equal that sum of state and local revenue. The balance ratio says what number does it take to make those equal? The sum of the four grants equal to the state and local dollars available. So it's just an equalizer in numbers. Currently it's about 1.12. Okay. And we'll get to that in a moment. I'll hold off on that. Any questions? Are you feeling math challenged yet?
Representative Hatt.
Thank you. If you change the $4,500 figure to $5,000, it really wouldn't matter, would it?
No, it would not. The balance ratio number would change to compensate.
So it could be zero or 10,000.
Yes. If that target number was flexible, you wouldn't need a balance ratio number. You would just calculate a new target number. Okay.
Thanks.
The eyes are glazing over.
Thank you.
Hello, Ramsey Berger. I've got a concept. Whatever money's left over.
That's
the divisible number.
That's it.
Period. End of subject. Three subtractions,
that's
divide,
it.
And there it is.
Mm-hmm. That's the equation.
Okay. All right. Now here what I've done is just taken the detail that we have added to each of those grants and written them down in place of a grant name. Okay? So in each of the corners you have one of the grants. Doesn't complicate it anymore if you see it that way, right? Just as the name of a grant in each corner. What we want to do now is to have a bit of a quiz, ungraded of course, and say, well, what happens if the state school fund dollar appropriation goes up? What changes? The formula recognizes that there's more state revenue. There's more state and local revenue together. Has to equal something. So the revenue for each district increases. And the mechanism for doing that is to increase the balance ratio number.
Okay.
We assume in this process that the transportation costs don't change, that they're spending what they have to spend to get the students to school. The construction grant doesn't change because it's already maxed out. The disability grant is maxed out. It all comes down to the general purpose grant going up for all of the districts. Because the balance factor has gone up, that makes the general purpose go up, affects all school districts. What happens if local revenue for one school district increases dramatically for whatever reason? Maybe there's a nuclear power plant that's taxable in the school district. Local revenue increases for that one school district. Again, the formula says, all right, there's more local revenue, there's the same amount of state revenue. The sum of those four grants has to increase to make things balance again. Okay? Since it's in the general purpose grant, every school district has a little bit higher formula allocation in state and local revenue. Every district. What happens to that school district where all of the increase in local revenue occurred? The formula says, yeah, they get a little bit more too, but they have this much higher local revenue now, therefore the state dollars have to go down. those state dollars is what helps the other school districts up in that process. So even though those local revenue dollars only increased in that one district, the effect of the formula applied to those is to spread it statewide.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Oh, go ahead, and then I have a follow-up. Representative Haas.
Well, if I could comment on this, this is, I think, what Steve's talking about is just a critical point of understanding here, because this came up a lot in the prior sessions, and the reality is that in Portland, which has what you would call property-rich and wealthier areas, there has, in some quarters, been resentment because, in effect, that money comes down to Salem and is divvied up and spread out equally, which is fine, but it's an important distinction. That's how we get equalization. And in your example, if Beaverton had the nuclear plant, it was taxed highly. In effect, those local revenues would be passed out to the rest of the state, in effect.
Right.
And the way that I try to explain this away to Beaverton or Hillsborough or wherever is that we're all in this together under equalization, and there are no more rich and poor districts. And that is something that I think we've been debating quite a bit in this room, in this committee, about whether that makes sense or not.
Thank you. And I want to give it, if you could clarify for me with an example, and then Representative Escobar, if you'll follow from there. Now, let's use Portland Public as an example again. Portland Public, sometimes gets additional revenue from the mayor's office. They hear that the funding formula is not meeting their needs, and so the business enterprises up there or whoever gets together and they get additional money from the mayor's office. So they get state revenue, and then look at the top of that grid, and then they have local revenues. So those, again, are combined, and yet some of the state revenue comes back to us under those conditions to the rest of the state, or help me out just a little bit on that.
Madam Chair, the dollars that you're talking about from the mayor or whomever aren't considered local dollars in the formula.
Okay, they're not.
They're not.
What are they considered?
Just extra dollars, extra revenue for the school district. Yes.
Okay, so that's not put into the formula whatsoever.
It is not.
So like Representative Haas is saying, then that wouldn't be shared with the rest of us.
No, that wouldn't, if I can, Madam Chair. That's like a foundation, as Portland Schools Foundation or the Woodburn School Foundation, just sort of money raised by, that's bake sale money.
It's a gift.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure if it went back into the formula. Representative Escobar.
Yes, I was on the workshop for decentralization of school funding through the Senate revenue in the interim, and that was actually the challenge that we were looking at was, you look at Portland has a tax. Springfield, I believe, has a tax. Eugene has one. Ashland has one. And what... The question was, are we getting back to pre-Proposition 5? Because what was the reason for Proposition 5? Equalization. Yet now we're enhancing our school districts through local revenues, again, similar to where we were at before we embarked upon Proposition 5. So, and I look for more districts to do the same. More communities, I think, shall go forth, raise local taxes, to enhance their school funding.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Just really quickly, I just can't. This is, I don't want to go up and have a debate, but I would respond that Measure 5 was about many things, and that was not
one
indeed
okay.
Primarily what Measure 5 was about.
Thanks, Representative Galizio. Well, we gave Steve, time. You've got another question? Well, I was going to say we can get Steve back to work. He had time for a drink of water. Representative Goldquist.
I guess, just to clarification, my point, Madam Chair, and I think Steve can do this, is that despite the equalization formula, it is fairly common to see what, because we hear it all the time, especially minors, from one school district spending $5,000 per student and another school district maybe elsewhere in the state spending $8,000 or $9,000 per student. Is that not correct? Even though we have an equalization formula.
It's possible, depending on what those other revenues are.
Thank you.
I was going to say one last one, and then we're going to move on, because otherwise we're going to get stuck in the formula before right. We want to get started on it.
I just want to say that difference, not just because of where the money comes from, but because of the weighting factors, would be a big factor on that per student cost. Is that right?
On differences in dollars per weighted student, yes. And if there's time, I'll comment more on that later.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
There was one. Well, I don't know if to do this or not, but what happens when local revenue exceeds the amount that the formula would allocate to that school district?
Thank you.
The state school fund dollars are zero. But it would still have more dollars than what the formula would indicate that they should have.
Okay.
Right? That can happen. It does happen fairly regularly for a couple of districts. But just to clue you in on that. Out of the $3.5 billion for 03-04, in formula revenue for schools, most of it is general purpose grant, 95.5% of it. That's why the weights are so important. Most of the dollars are going into the general purpose grant. The drivers, the weights. Okay. The transportation grant is about 4%, and then high cost disability and facility, less than 0.5% each. Very minor so far. The payment schedule was changed in the special session of 2002, the June one. It was spread out a little bit more evenly, starting with a July payment worth 2 months in July, none in June, and then a regular equal monthly amounts for the rest of the year. It's substantially different than the old system, but since it's changed, I won't dwell on it. Okay, a little bit in terms of numbers now, formula revenue since 1990-91. Couple things to point out here is that both in 02-03 was less than the prior year, and 04-05 is going to be less than the prior year. So we got a little bit of up and down going on right now. Okay. There is precedent for it to go down. 93-94 was less than 92-93, but we haven't had the up and down pattern before. And then you can see how the local portion has changed with the ballot measure 5s and 50. You've seen that in property taxes, so I'm going to comment on that. The other thing, you see the little boxes at the top beginning in 97-98, the outlines. That represents other dollars that was distributed to school districts. It was considered part of the school funding package, but it was dollars that did not go through the formula. They were distributed primarily based on weighted students, but not in the formula. And a lot of this money was from lottery-backed bonds that were sold. Okay. So in your lottery discussion, you had lottery dollars going to pay off bonds. This is some of that money distributed in those years. On a per-student basis, you can see how that's changed over time. Again, the similar pattern, both calculated using ADMR and extended ADMW, even though it's not labeled that way, which is typical. Again, with this per student amounts on an ADMW or ADM basis being higher because ADM is the smaller number, and the growth pattern being a little bit slower on an ADMW extended basis because ADMW has grown faster than ADM. going back to the formula and the variation in the dollar amounts per weighted student, you can see here that the variation isn't a whole lot, right? If you look at the average and look at the number of districts that are within $100 plus or minus of that average, you'll get about 58% of the districts. Again, difference per weighted student. Fairly compact distribution. If you go out to a plus or minus $200, you have about 80% of the districts. This perhaps makes it even more clear. If you look at the jagged line, the pink line at the top, almost horizontal, but that's the variation now in 03, 04 on a per weighted student basis, measured in the hundreds of dollars. If you compare that to what it was in 91, 92, the bottom line, starting at $3,000 and going up to about $5,500, and that leaves out all of the small districts having less than 500 ADM. If I had all districts there, that 91, 92 line would go up to $9,000 or $10,000 per weighted student. So instead of being three or four times the difference between the high and the low, as in 91, 92, now it's very narrow. Through that equalization process. Any questions about school districts before moving into ESBs? All right. Quickly, just to point out that the last merger round for ESBs was in 1995, when there was 21 set up in statute. Yamhill has merged with Willamette ESD since then, so there are currently 20. The regions for ESDs is shown here. I myself find it hard to match up a name with a territory. I like to refer to the map. The one that has, well, the Northwest ESD has four counties. That's the largest number of counties or school districts in that county territory that make up an ESD. A couple of them have three counties. Most are one or two. ESDs have something called resolution services that is nothing comparable in the school district statutes. They have to agree on how to spend 90% of their state dollars and property tax dollars. And the resolution agree on what services they're going to provide. And the agreement has to be by two-thirds of the districts having at least 50% of the students in the ESD. This was put in the statutes again in 2001 when the equalization language was written for ESDs as a way to make the ESD more responsible to the services that their component school districts wanted them to provide. The dollar amounts you can see are much way smaller than for school districts, about $200 million in local dollars, approaching $150 million in state dollars. The general logic in 2001 or phasing in equalization was something like this, is that ESD's primary responsibility is to provide services to school districts so that their costs are related to school district costs. And since they already had a formula for school districts that took into account those cost factors, why don't we just use the school formula for the ESD distribution? Right? So that's basically what they decided to do, and then to just make it some percent or proportion to the school formula for the revenue of their component school districts. So going back to this format that you didn't want to see again, we have state revenue and local revenue equal to some percent of the component school formula revenue. There's one hitch in that we'll get to in the following slide, but initially at least we have a base revenue for each ESD calculated as 5.263% of the sum of the formula revenue for the component school districts. The 5.263 just is a way of saying, all right, the sum over there is 95% of the school districts got. 5.263% of 95% is 5%. That's the share that BSD should get. So it's just a method of coming back to that 5%. And again, starting in 05-06 and ignoring the phase-in. Okay, so we have the base revenue, but the legislation said, well, that's fine, 5.263% or 5% in total, but we think there's a minimum amount that each ESD should have to operate, especially those small Eastern ESDs. They should have at least $1 million beginning in 05-06. So their base, in effect, is increased to $1 million. But the base calculation is already distributed, the 5%. So if we're going to take and make it more than 5% or 5.263% for some ESDs, we have to get that money from the other ESDs. So there's a percent to balance factor again, taken times that base or 1 million, so that each ESD then gets about 99 point some percent of that amount, their base or their 1 million minimum. Okay. And there's at the time that this was passed and the $1 million was set, it wasn't expected that any district would be even at $1 million or below $1 million from this calculation. But that was assuming a steady growth in the state school fund over time, over that phase-in period. Didn't quite happen that way. So we do have some that will be at $1 million, times that 99 point percent. So for ESD equity, again, it's by definition. And your slide says something a little bit different than what I had written down. I guess the thing to keep in mind is that if you change the school formula distribution, you're going to change what happens to ESD in that process because of the link. Basically, you have one formula controlling both. Even though you may just see numbers for school districts, there will be a change in the numbers for ESDs as well, only perhaps not as dramatic. ESD revenue over time following the same pattern for school districts. And that's it for ESDs, and we can go into the local option if we're ready. You've already had information about the local option. What I want to bring to your attention is that the formula says property tax revenues are considered local revenue in the formula. Local option taxes are property taxes. They had to be specifically excluded from local revenue in the formula. Okay. That's what was done, and then but there was a limit set as to how much could be excluded. Again, to keep the range fairly narrow in terms of the high and lows for weighted students. So the limits for 15% of their formula revenue are $750 per student. So far, neither of those caps have come into play because it's the property tax gap that is still controlling how much can be raised. This is just an example. Since the 15% is a percent of a dollar amount, the formula dollar amount that will increase over time, that can keep going up. The 750 then will be the lesser of those two, probably in the future. And then it's a matter of, well, is the gap large enough to fund anywhere near the $750 per weighted student? And so far it has not. To give you an idea of the success rate for local option elections for schools, I've listed them here for since The option was available in 1991. Voters have not been too willing to pass local options. The percent pass rate is about 37%. It's varied quite a bit from year to year and from the election type to election type, whether it's a special election, primary, or general. The other thing I want to point out here is that for general operating revenues, the local option can only last for a maximum of 5 years. Most of these were passed in 2000. They're ending their lifespan. And so of those seven elections in 2004, six of those were to renew local options and was not, in effect, new dollars to the districts. Right. So the elections are currently being held to continue that in, I guess it would be 05-06. The other thing, I did an analysis on this, and there's a research report available. What I found is that the passage rate goes up dramatically in districts that have high property value per student. It also tends to be higher in large districts and fairly small districts. There are some small districts that have high property value per student. So there can be that correlation. But perhaps the small districts just have a better rapport with their voters, too, than some of the medium-sized districts. And then the larger districts tend to have more property value so that they can raise money with a lower tax rate. I hesitate to even talk about this one. Local option equalization, what it's all about is trying to provide equal revenue for equal effort. So if two school districts are both having a $1 local option tax rate, that those two districts can raise the same amount of revenue in total as the 75th percentile district, right? So the 75th percentile or the target district has so much property value per student. All of the districts that are below that in property value per student, if they have a local option, will qualify for some state equalization dollars to bring them up to what that $1 rate would have raised in the target district. I'm getting good. I knew I shouldn't have started on this. Should have skipped this one. But anyway, it's an equalization mechanism that's applied to local option, again, to try to make districts have comparable revenue from the same tax rate. Okay? Equal revenue for equal effort, but the effort being the tax rate. There's no questions on that section, I'm sure. So let's go to this.
Any questions?
Formerly the Education Endowment Fund. Okay, the voters approved the Education Stability Fund in 2002 by a constitutional vote. It's funded by 18% of the net lottery earnings. You've talked about that already. It's limited in size to 5% of the general fund. And the uses then are broader than just K-12. It can be pre-K, it can be college, it can be continuing education, it can be workforce training. Any of those uses are possible. So far, it's only been used for K-12 education. How do you get money out? That was the main reason for changing the endowment fund to a stability fund, to be able to use the principal in the fund to support schools. Paul's the expert on the trigger combinations, but there's four of them, and they're a combination either economic, budgetary, or political, along with a political vote by both chambers, a three-fifths yes vote. Okay? The economic trigger is to have two consecutive quarters of declining non-farm employment within the last 12 months. That's one possibility, along with the political vote. There's two budgetary triggers, one kind of looking forward, so that if you have a general fund appropriation and then the forecast for the next biennium start going down and go down at least 3% in the last quarterly forecast, that can be a trigger to have a vote. Or if you have a quarterly forecast that's down 2% or more from the revenue forecast for the adopted budget, you're after session, you're in the interim, the forecast starts falling, is when it falls down more than 2%, then that trigger is met and you could have a vote to see if you want to then withdraw principle. The fourth is the governor declares an emergency and the legislature again approves by a three-fifths vote. It's not very clear what the emergency has to be about. It just has to be an emergency.
Representative Berger.
So you've got four scenarios but three boxes. Am I correct, Steve?
Correct.
And there are two scenarios in the third, in the second box.
Correct. Two budgetary.
Yes. And any one individually of these four scenarios could trigger.
Correct.
Just clarify.
You've got it. Representative
Oakley? Thank you, Madam Chair. See, that assumes there's money in the stability fund, right?
Yes. It hasn't gone dry yet. If it's under the 5% cap for the general fund, then currently 10% of the deposits go into the Oregon Growth Account. That is invested separately in startup businesses. It's venture capital primarily. If it goes, should for some miracle go over the 5% cap, so the lottery funds stop going into it, then 15% of that lottery income goes into the school capital matching sub account. Not 18%, 15%. Okay? May happen, not too likely, at least in the near future. Reach that. It'd probably take, even with no withdrawal of additional funds in the future, it'd probably take, you know, 10, 12 years to get to the cap.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hess?
So, thank you. So what you're saying there is, it, unlike endowments, that it doesn't just generate interest or proceeds and keep building up that way. It only generates money from deposits from the lottery.
The interest earnings are distributed,
right.
75% to lottery bond debt service, 25% for scholarships. So that never accumulates.
Right, that's.
It's only the new deposits that increase the fund. So if you look at this table, it tries to show you how it has grown over the last few years. Right, about currently, or the estimated deposits are about a little over $70 million a year in the 05-07 biennium. There's been two withdrawals, again for just schools, in 02-03 and in 04-05, currently about $122.7 million. The estimated balance at the end of the biennium is around $33 million. So there's not a lot there to draw out at the beginning of the biennium, but it will accumulate during the biennium. And if none is withdrawn, if none of the triggers are met, then at the end of the biennium, you could potentially have about $180 million in that fund.
Paul has some comments.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out Steve's numbers are their current law forecast and the December forecast, and you heard the lottery director here yesterday talking about the additional dollar target, $120 million in the governor's budget. In the forecast, we're not assuming that's current law at this point until the commission approves that. So
That 120 million, 18% of it that's realized, 18% of that would be added on top of these numbers.
Okay, finishing up. Governor's budget, 0507 biennium. 5 billion for the state school fund, a half a million for local option equalization. If we add local revenue to that, there's over $2.5 billion in local revenue. There's about $7.5 billion in revenue for the school for the formula dollars for both school districts and ESDs. The school district portion is about $7.1 billion, the 95%. The other thing, backing up here, one slide, there's nothing that says how that $5 billion has to be divided between the two fiscal years. It's divided up currently on the basis of state and local being about 49% in the first year of the biennium, 51% in the second year of the biennium, allowing about a 4% growth rate from the first year to the second year in the biennium. But that split will be in the appropriation bill as to what it is first year, second year for state school fund dollars. Okay, ESDs get about $377 million for the biennium, including local revenue. And finally, the formula issues will likely center around these topics. The first three are very likely to have bills proposed. The next two are probable. The two after that are maybes, and the third, last one, is probably not likely. There hasn't been any legislation proposed to change the teacher experience factor yet.
Well, we have 3 minutes before 3 o'clock. Any questions to Steve?
I didn't intend to leave any time for questions.
Smart man.
With that, Paul, do you have some announcements before we adjourn the meeting?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will distribute to you a little map, which those of you who have not visited the lottery, show you how to get there. It's given its proximity, it's basically right down State Street here, so it's only about 3 miles. You go down right straight down State Street, turn right on Airport Road, and it's right there on the left. The committee will meet there at 1 o'clock tomorrow at the front desk. As you go in, there's a big front area. Don't go over in the winter section. There's a main desk, and they'll be there expecting you. And the director was saying that he anticipated meeting with you till about 2:30. So from about 1 to 2:30 for your scheduling. Mazin will be there, and he will be on the tour with you, and Christy will be there as well. It is a public meeting, so the public could attend and participate if they so choose. So we will be keeping record as a public meeting.
Does the meeting need to be opened and adjourned as our normal protocols then?
Yeah, Christine. I wanted to check on that.
Okay. And Chairman Butler is still out ill today, so we did miss him. And we hope he gets healthy quickly.
Madam Chair, yeah, the word we have is he will be returning on Monday.
Good. Good. He's missed. Any other announcements or for the good of the order? This meeting is adjourned.